Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm your host Priya Menon, joining you from India. This is Cure Talks 125th episode, and today we are discussing precision medicine, identifying targeted cancer treatments with genomic testing. Precision or personalized medicine has made a sea change in cancer treatment. A pipe dream for most patients about 10 years ago, it is a reality today. Precision medicine's keystone is the ability to identify personal gene characteristics and match them to specific treatment options. Today's discussion hopes to answer your common questions surrounding precision medicine. We have a knowledgeable panel of physicians, patients, and patient advocates here on Cure Talks. Let us meet the panel first. We have Professor William Burhan, who is a senior cancer scientist at Roswell Park Cancer Institute. Joining him is Dr. Prasanth Reddy, who is senior director in medical affairs at Foundation Medicine. Dr. Samuel Kleppner is clinical and translational researcher at the Angeles Clinic in Los Angeles. Dr. Sharon Stanley, a cancer patient, also an osteopathic physician. She leads the Bellingham Osteopathic Center along with her husband, Dr. Keith Swan. Moik Scott, who is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International and also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases. David Marshak, Manager of Patient Advocacy at Foundation Medicine. Moderating the panel is Rick Davis, who is a nationally recognized patient advocate and founder of Answer Cancer Foundation. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone. It's a real pleasure to have you all here today. Just for the listeners, we will be addressing questions towards the end of the discussion. You can press 1 on your keypad to let us know if you have a question to ask, and we will bring you on air. You may also mail the question to priya@trialx.com or post them on curetalks.com. With that, I will now hand over to Rick to begin with the panel discussion. Rick, you're on.
Good evening, good afternoon, everybody. And I am just thrilled that we have such an illustrious panel gathered together today to talk about a very complicated subject, which we are going to try and make very simple for everybody to understand and realize the importance, the burgeoning importance of precision medicine. We have a lot to get through, so I've asked the panel to be pretty concise so that we can have plenty of time for questions at the end. We already have a significant number of questions. So with that, we're going to kick off with Dr. Samuel Kleppner. And Dr. Kleppner, perhaps you can just explain what precision or personalized medicine is. Maybe there's a difference, maybe there isn't. And also clarify the difference between genetic and genomic testing and sequencing. So we've introduced you, and if you could just give us a very brief explanation of what precision or personalized medicine is and whether precision and personalized medicine are the same thing and what the difference is between genetic and genomic sequence.
Sure. So precision medicine is really an approach to the care of cancer in which we're trying to match the best therapy with the optimal patient. And in order to do that, we look to as much information about both the patient as well as their disease as possible. And so in cancer, this has fallen a lot into the genomic space where we're looking at the changes in the tumor cells, which are different from the changes in the normal cells. When we think about genetics versus genomics, you know, it's really more of a semantics discussion. But in general, genetics refers to germline changes, which are changes that are present in all of the cells in our body, both the normal cells and any tumors that that patient were to get. Genomic, generally in the cancer space, refers to changes that happen in the tumor cells only. So if you analyze a tumor cell by DNA sequencing, you will find changes in the tumor cells that are different from the normal cells. if there's a gene that's present in the normal cells, it will also be present in the tumor cells. So if you truly need to analyze both the tumor and the normal DNA, then you need what's called a matched normal control. So you get a piece of the tumor and then generally either a piece of normal tissue or blood, and then you can truly distinguish genomic changes in the tumor from genetic changes that can be passed on. Tumor changes cannot be passed on from one individual to another, and that's an important distinction and sometimes an area of confusion.
So in other words, when we talk about genetic testing, most of the time we're talking about genes that have been inherited from family members, whereas if we talk about genomic testing, we're talking about your own tumor, somatic changes from your own tumor.
Yes, I think that's an accurate summary. And genetic testing looks at, you know, genes which may increase your risk of developing a cancer, and genomic changes are changes that are acquired in the tumor, and those are considered more likely to be targets for precision medicine therapy or targeted therapies.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Preddy, would you like to add anything to that? And maybe you could just talk to us a little bit about who is a good candidate to get tested and what exactly they're getting tested for.
Sure, Rick. My feeling is really all patients with a diagnosis of cancer should at some point in their clinical journey undergo testing to identify some of these genomic molecular changes that are contributing to their disease. You know, a deep understanding of these molecular changes have already led to a transformation in cancer care in diseases like chronic myelogenous leukemia, breast cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, and the list goes on and on, where individual treatment decisions can be made at each individual patient level. Certainly, we need to continue to study, preferably in a clinical trial setting, if at all available, how genomic information can be best used to inform these individual patient treatment decisions. I do believe that taking a larger panel kind of approach of molecular testing, like a comprehensive genomic profile approach, is more likely to capture, you know, any given molecular alteration, and can be a valuable first pass at identifying mutations that could underlie a predisposition to cancer. Certainly, patients that are most likely to benefit from obtaining comprehensive genomic profiling early in their clinical journey may be those patients with known aggressive cancers, such as sarcomas, cancers with well-documented targetable alterations like non-small cell lung cancer, patients with rare or hard-to-define cancers, such as carcinoma of unknown primary, and certainly patients are likely to benefit who have failed multiple, quote, standard therapies like chemotherapy as well. The testing can be done on, you know, tissue after a biopsy of the patient's tumor or other samples that may have tumor DNA as well, such as in the blood or sometimes in the urine. And detecting these changes are likely to play a critical role in helping your physician, your doctor, choose between several treatment options, whether it's standard chemotherapy or a targeted therapy, or maybe even harnessing a patient's own immune system to fight their cancer, the so-called immunotherapies. And whether a patient has, or just as importantly, doesn't have a specific mutation can help you prioritize between these therapies as well.
And Dr. Preddy, how exactly does a patient get tested?
So, you know, the actual process is relatively straightforward for the patient. Like I said, in most instances, we do the testing on the tumor itself. So at the time of diagnosis, and again, diagnosis is going to be obtained through a tissue biopsy in most cases. In this particular situation, what we would do is then obtain the tissue from the biopsy sample, and then that tissue would be processed, you know, undergoing a number of steps, and without getting into the weeds, where we basically extract the DNA then analyze the DNA for these molecular changes. Sometimes we also analyze a cousin of DNA called RNA to detect some of these changes. And then we're able to then decide which one of these alterations are likely driving the patient's cancer, and then hopefully based on that information, then make a decision on how best to treat that individual patient.
Mm-hmm. And by and large, your observation has been that most of this genomic testing for treatments that are indicated by changes in the actual tumor itself are done later in the disease stage rather than at the time of diagnosis.
Yeah, this is an area that's actively being studied. I would tell you that in most instances, the clinical utility of this kind of testing tends to be in patients that tend to have more advanced disease, if you will, metastatic disease or stage four disease. A number of trials are underway to see whether patients may benefit from this kind of approach, perhaps earlier in their disease, earlier stage patients, stage two or stage three patients in certain kinds of cancers.
And Dr. Petty, some of our listeners may have heard about liquid biopsies. Who might be eligible for a liquid biopsy, and why would you get a liquid biopsy, and is it inferior to a tissue biopsy?
So it's an excellent question, Rick. It's a difficult question to 100% narrow down. Everybody is eligible for a liquid biopsy. However, not all tumors shed DNA into the blood. And separate from that fact, there is some potential that the findings that we have in the tissue don't always line up with the findings that we have in the blood. And that's, you know, essentially what we term discordance between the findings in the tumor tissue versus the blood. So the bottom line is at this point in time, what I would say is sampling the tissue and the blood are complementary to each other. And I would encourage patients, you know, to discuss this further with their individual physician as to why we might start with tissue or blood-based testing up front. There's a handful of reasons why we might prefer to use blood-based testing right up front, and those include patients that may have contraindications or reasons why they're at high risk for getting tissue-based testing, either because of conditions that they have, such as being on anticoagulation, the location of the tumor, patient preference, et cetera.
I want to come back to Dr. Klempner. Dr. Prady mentioned briefly that you do some testing and maybe from that test you find another treatment. So why exactly would you encourage your patient, one of your patients, to get tested? And what might you hope would come out of that test? And how exactly would it indicate a different type of treatment?
Yeah, this is a great question and an area of my own research. So I think I would call the analogy to like a pie. You know, we're continuously trying to divide cancer up into smaller and smaller pieces of the pie, and these slices of the pie tend to be molecularly defined subgroups. So the classical teaching that a breast cancer and a lung cancer and a colon cancer are very different has been called into question by some of these large-scale genomic analyses, where you see that a mutation that may be more common in lung but may exist rarely in a colon cancer or an esophageal cancer or a breast cancer may respond to the same therapy targeted at that specific change. So the paradigm of looking and examining everyone's tumor to determine whether or not they fall into any of these molecular subgroups is really the approach that has become more broadly adopted in cancer as a whole and continues to be tested in a lot of these large multi-arm basket trials. The National Cancer Institute has a trial called the MATCH. The American Society of Clinical Oncology has a trial called the TAPER study, which are prospectively testing this exact question, whether or not we should base the therapy independent of the anatomic location, but more based on the genomic changes. Dr. Reddy also touched on another important area, which is immunotherapy. And so there may be some early biomarkers, you know, trying to decide who's the most likely to benefit from a given therapy is a very important area of cancer. And some things like a very high number of mutations in a cancer, something called microsatellite instability or other mutations which can produce a very high mutational burden, such as POLE mutations, these may identify patients regardless of where the tumor started that may respond to a given immunotherapy. So it really is about trying to identify patient subgroups where you can match the patient against the optimal therapy based on some biologic information, whether that be funneling the patient towards immunotherapy, towards a small molecule inhibitor about a specific point mutation, or a rearrangement. Really, it's really trying to divide it up as into these little slivers to identify the people. And I think the fact that those exist rarely across tumor types really underscores the importance of sort of a broad profiling-based approach, which is, you know, now endorsed by the guidelines for a couple tumor types.
Mm-hmm. So this really points to a couple of treatments that were identified for two of our panelists, both of whom have a fairly unique background. Dr. Stanley herself is an osteopathic doctor, and I believe that the drug you took, Dr. Stanley, was a drug that was, I think, first approved for the lung cancer. I'm trying to remember, Keytruda.
Yes, that's right.
And yes. what sort of cancer did you have? And why do you think that? How did genomic sequencing help you in your treatment path?
Well, fundamentally, I'm alive because of it. I had uterine cancer, advanced stage, very aggressive type of sarcoma, that I went through a chemotherapeutic regimen, which I also had the Wiesenthal protocol done on, which was individual, but I didn't go into a full remission. And because I was at the Angeles Clinic and had a PD-L1 and a POLE mutation, suddenly it didn't matter that it was uterine cancer. There was an opportunity, because of the number of mutations as well, to get on Keytruda, which I've responded very well to over the past year. If this hadn't happened, statistically, the likelihood of me being alive at this point was under 10%.
Wow.
And now, you know, I'm headed into what appears to be a full remission. And
congratulations. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. And even better news, that it's an opportunity for individual treatment based on these markers as opposed to the classic treatment of tumors based on tissue type. I was given this immunotherapy that, unlike chemotherapy, where the great number of mutations I had would limit that and make it obsolete and not doable any further, this could continue to help me if I need it over a long period of time. So I really would love for patients everywhere to have this sort of possibility.
And Professor Burns, I have to admit to the audience I have a little back history to your situation, where you were researching a drug for several years that had been approved for ovarian cancer. Now, I'm fairly confident in saying you did not have ovarian cancer.
Yes, correct.
But you did have fairly advanced prostate cancer, and maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about how genomic sequencing helped you and the drug that you're taking and how else it's used.
Sure. So I do have to tell you, to start off, Rick, though, that I was asked the question once by a clinician on the telephone whether or not I had ovarian cancer or a hysterectomy. So it sometimes those mistakes are made. So I was diagnosed in 2013 with an aggressive prostate adenocarcinoma. And I went through all of the usual treatments that are applied in that case. And because of the aggressive nature of my tumor, the benefits of those treatments lasted only for a very short time before, progression of the tumor would ramp up again. I was tested for germline mutations. So this is the genetics testing that Dr. Klumpner was speaking about at the beginning of this discussion. My entire germline was sequenced, and it was determined that I had a mutation in the BRCA2 gene, which is associated more frequently with ovarian and breast cancer. But it does, in fact, drive prostate cancer in some cases as well. I should also point out that I had a very strong history of cancer in my family, which made it certainly worthwhile to be tested for germline mutations. After it was determined that I had a pathogenic mutation in the BRCA2 gene, I began treatment with a drug called olaparib, which was approved last year for treatment of ovarian cancer patients who also had mutations in this gene as well as a related gene. And I have been treated with this drug now for a little more than 2 years. I was told at the beginning of my treatment or right before it started, that I probably had no more than a few months of survival left. And at this point, I am almost completely free of metastatic lesions. I have one metastatic lesion that's detectable in bone scans. And
Incredible. And
I'm healthy as a horse otherwise. So I think this is similar to Dr. Stanley's success of her treatment. This is a tremendous example of the utility of application of genetics to cancer treatment.
Mm. So, I don't want to stack the deck too heavily. And so we've heard definitely about the pros of testing. Are there any cons to testing, Mike Scott? And what should people watch out for if they're considering genomic sequencing or genetic sequencing for that matter?
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Sorry.
We can hear you now. So let me just hold you off just for a second. I just want to go back to Sharon. I think Sharon wanted to respond to something that Bill said. Is that right, Sharon?
Well, congratulations to you too. It's really wonderful to still be here, and I too am fully healthy and just moved practices and spending a significant amount of time informing patients about this as a possibility, and I know this will segue into
the issues of pitfalls in terms of insurance coverage and educating other physicians and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, we will come to that. But what I also want to do is I want to go to Mike, because, Mike, I don't know if you heard me, but I'm concerned that somebody's going to accuse me of stacking the deck here. And we've heard about the pros, but what are the disadvantages, or why might somebody want to be wary of getting either a genetic or a genomic test?
Yeah, I think we need to be very careful of language here. The risk is not the test itself. Tests provide information, and it is the interpretation of that data and the potential consequences of that interpretation of that data that can provide difficulties for different people. And I don't want to take anything away at all from what's been said about the two successes. We know a number of diseases now that will, when you have the correct genetic mutations within the tumors, respond extremely well to various different types of therapy. And this goes back years to things like the Philadelphia chromosome in patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia. So we understand this, the potential well. The problem is, if you look at a disease, and I'll use prostate cancer because several of us know about it, where progressive disease is often a matter of multiple mutations. It's not just one particular mutation that is a problem. And so interpreting exactly what the genomics may imply in a particular patient is complicated. And we don't necessarily have data that says for many patients that any particular drug will work that much better in them. So the way I like to think about all of this is that it is best considered, unless we have very well-defined situations, which we do for the BRCA1/2 patients, which we do for patients with Philadelphia chromosome and CML and some others. But outside that scope, we are basically practicing translational medicine in clinical real time. And that's best done within clinical trials where we have very highly defined situations. And it is incumbent upon the researchers to explain carefully to patients exactly what the risks and benefits of any particular form of treatment are based on any particular form of genetic or genomic information. The test itself is not a risk. It's the potential consequences.
It's the same old story. The test is just about information. It's what you do with that information that is always the problem. Dr. Klempner, you have to address this situation on a day-to-day basis, the situation that Mike talks about the appropriateness of selecting treatments where we're not exactly sure if that gene mutation will respond or will not respond. How do you address that with your patients?
Yeah, so I think this differs a little bit by practice setting. You know, I'm lucky enough to practice in a place where we have, you know, molecular tumor boards and expert consensuses and are able to participate in a lot of the prospective mechanisms, such as the ASCO taper trial and the NCI match trial, which I agree with, are generally the preferred mechanisms to examine this question. But in many situations, clinical trials may not be available due to just availability of the trial, distance to a trial site location for patients. So we are forced to make judgment calls based on the cumulative data that's out there, and there's varying levels of evidence. So you have prospective, you know, large phase trials, which provide very good support for a decision, down to anecdotal evidence from case reports and preclinical work, which may provide a good signal, but certainly not the same level of data. So you have to examine each case individually and whether or not the patient has, you know, experienced all of the standard options, which have been proven to be of benefit on the average in clinical trials. If they have exhausted standard options, or if they're not a candidate for standard options, or if they have a tumor type that has documented responses to a particular mutation, those are pieces of information that we factor into this decision, but ultimately it comes down to a discussion with the patient about the risk and benefit of the therapies. And I think I would agree with Mike, it's critical to understand that the treatment decision may be based on a large amount of information, or it may be based on limited amount of information. And in those situations, you know, seeking the opinions of people who have experience with this type of testing or this type of approach, I think is beneficial. You know, seeking consultation with academic institutions with molecular tumor boards where you can feel supported by the consensus of people who deal with this on a daily basis. I think all of these things are important, but a general approach has been to try to incorporate clinical trials as much as possible so that we can all learn about this approach more. So the discussion really comes down to the cumulative analysis of the data for a given alteration in a given patient, and then the discussion of the actual side effects of the therapy and whether that risk balance is comfortable with both the patient and the physician. And if not, then probably additional opinions are warranted before embarking on a course that is perhaps based on less evidence.
So this is all well and good when a patient is living in a big city, maybe attending a center of excellence, or a sophisticated practitioner like yourself who works with centers of excellence and is well aware of what's going on. But I am sure there are a bunch of people listening who live in smaller towns and cities around this country and elsewhere where they are treated by oncologists who practice community medicine and may not even be aware of some of these recent advances, remarkable recent advances in cancer treatment. But they listen to us, and then they go in and they talk to their doctor, and their doctor rolls their eyes and says, well, you know, I don't know what the application is for this for you. How, Dr. Preddy, how do you suggest that patients educate their doctors, as Sharon mentioned earlier on, as Dr. Stanley mentioned earlier on, how do they go about educating their doctors and bringing these advances to their knowledge so these patients in lesser centers can get treated?
Yeah, this is the critical challenge, I think, Rick. As Mike said, the information is not necessarily the bad thing. It's the interpretation. But the first step is to get the information in the first place. And so if we don't empower our patients to at least get the information so that we can then decide whether the next best step is a clinical trial or potentially off-label treatment if a clinical trial is not found or accessible, that's the critical question. And so I think part of this is an education of the patients as well to bring up the topic with their physicians themselves. That's the first step. And secondary to that, obviously, the field itself needs to continue to educate patients through their professional societies, such as ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology. We have to do a better job, the physicians that have some expertise in this area, in sharing that information, either through conferences, seminars, and other educational venues. And so, but I do think that patients should be empowered. Our job mm-hmm. is to ensure that patients have mm-hmm. access to all of the potential tools that they could use in their fight against cancer. And part of that stems from at least knowing this critical piece of information mm-hmm. about their cancer.
Mm-hmm. So, Rick, could I just comment on that? I live in just outside a large city on the East Coast, and something is going on here that I actually find rather worrisome, which is that a number of the major cancer centers in the region are actually indulging in what I would describe as competitive advertising about how wonderfully they can now treat nearly everything cancerous. And I am a great believer in the value of hope in the management of cancer, but I also find that the nature of that advertising very distasteful, because the details are not available to the patients in that advertising, and everything is presented in an extraordinarily positive light when the reality just isn't that at all. Yes, we get these phenomenal responses, but we don't hear about the patients who don't get the good responses.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say I find that concerning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. David, before you were patient, you were director of patient advocacy for Foundation Medicine. You spent 2 or 3 years interfacing directly with patients themselves when they had issues about getting tested. Do you have anything to add on how patients can bring attention to their doctors in the community setting? Do you have anything to add to what Mike said about overuse creating an over-optimistic view of testing?
I think, Rick, that having the most comprehensive picture is helpful. And so, you know, for all the patients listening into this call, you know, whether you know a lot about this kind of testing already and you're looking to supplement your knowledge, or you may be learning about a lot of this for the first time, you're doing the right thing. There are a lot of patient advocacy groups out there that are really striving to give patients the information they need as well. So that's another opportunity, is to get involved with an advocacy group, potentially for that specific type of cancer, and just continue to find opportunities to learn about your specific cancer and how testing could potentially provide options. At the same time, keeping in mind that testing is not going to provide an answer for everybody. It's about providing the opportunity for an answer, and that if there is a treatment out there, a targeted therapy or an immunotherapy or something that's in the clinical trial setting, it would be beneficial that you know about that by getting testing. So I think, like Dr. Reddy said, there's work to be done on both sides, with community oncologists throughout the country at conferences and other opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I know from actually having attended a recent Community Oncology Association conference that these conversations are happening. But there certainly are going to be patients who encounter physicians who are less open to this. And so just taking advantage of as many opportunities to learn about how this could impact them, and taking some of the general information provided here and how it might apply to their specific cancer, and just continue to ask questions and hopefully be on the right progress.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go to our questions, I have one last area that I want to touch on with you, David. How affordable is genetic and genomic sequencing, and what is the attitude of insurance companies to covering these costs?
Mm-hmm. That's something that's very top of mind for patients. It's, if not one of the first questions, one of the maybe the second question that gets asked, because, you know, cancer treatment is expensive, the therapies, various aspects of care, hospitalizations, and so something like this, which could provide helpful information but has a financial cost, is a factor. And so you know, the answer is that it varies, and so I can give a little bit of context, but want to stress that each patient, based on their insurance and how that may apply, may vary. But to give kind of some general framework, at Foundation Medicine, where we do genomic testing, We do accept all insurances. Insurance often covers testing, and then the patient may have some out-of-pocket expense like a copay or deductible. Insurance does not always cover this, and in those situations, we would pursue appeals on behalf of patients. Out-of-pocket expenses can vary quite a bit based on insurance tests performed. But just as kind of a baseline, the list price for the Foundation One test is $5,800. That's not what a patient would pay. That's the list price. And for someone considering a test, whether it's at our company or another facility that performs testing, at least at our company, we have a program where a patient can fill out a financial assistance application, and that can give an idea upfront what the maximum out-of-pocket expense would be. So, you know, insurance gets billed after testing, so you don't always know upfront what the insurance will or will not cover, but filling out the financial assistance application can give you that idea upfront, at least what the maximum amount would be. And we also have a client services group available to talk through the particulars of anyone's situation so that they can get a better sense upfront of what the cost to them might be. And one other point I'd add is in terms of thinking about cost is just considering it in the larger context of just the cost of the testing, which is the fact that potentially finding a therapy as a result of the test could provide an opportunity for a patient to get on a therapy which is more individualized for them versus being on a potentially less effective therapy which they're paying for. So that's something to consider. But as has been mentioned early, just keeping in mind that not every patient is going to get that answer.
Could I ask another question about that, Rick?
I'll come right back to you, but let me just follow up with one question, if I may, with David, because I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, what exactly is it going to cost me out of pocket? Now, obviously, it depends on each person's financial situation, but by and large, across the board over the last 2 or 3 years, what sort of range do you see the patient having to pick up? You know, is it $100, $500? Is it usually a little more than $100, but no less than $1,000? Can you give us some feel at all?
I can give a very broad range, but I think it's not that much more than what you said. I don't have access to that data in terms of seeing patient by patient what their out-of-pocket expense would be. But I think when you consider, you know, copays or deductibles, those can be on the range of hundreds or sometimes more for patients who pay out-of-pocket a self-pay price. That is significantly reduced from the list price. But so there are patients who could have a few thousand dollars charged to them, but it does range quite a bit.
Thanks. And Mike, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I was just curious whether insurance is more likely to pay when the tests are used to find specific genes where we know there are effective therapies, as opposed to the situation where we're hoping to. I mean, obviously in lung cancer, in CML, in some other conditions, we have very good information about where specific genetic change has therapeutic benefits associated with it from particular drugs.
Mm-hmm. The answer is yes, and you provided the example of lung cancer, and in fact for non-small cell lung cancer, we have been starting to get payments from Medicare in that area, and so I think you can see that in certain types of cancer where there are those kind of larger list of approved therapies associated with that specific cancer, that can affect reimbursement.
Thank you.
So, Priya, I'm sure we have some people queued up for questions. I would just like to ask all of the questioners, those with questions, to please just focus on the question and rather than your own medical history, because the doctors I can't really answer anything about your own medical history, so keep the questions as general as you can and as short as you can. Priya?
Yes, Rika, I have the questions here.
Do we have anybody on the phone, Priya, who would like to ask a question?
No, Rick, they've just sent in a couple of questions now as the talk is going on, so I'll just quickly go over them, yes?
Let me just first of all go to David, and maybe you can communicate them to David. But I just want to make sure we didn't have anybody queued up waiting to ask a question on the telephone. Let us know if somebody comes in on the telephone, and we'll try and get them in. David, since you've answered so many of these questions over the last several years, perhaps you can pick out some of the questions that have been asked and we haven't covered yet.
Yep. There have been some questions that have come through, which I can see, which I think build nicely on the discussion we've been having. One of them, which we, I think, briefly touched on, but could go a little more detail, is the timing of utilizing the results of genomic testing. Sometimes patients may be looking to get treatment soon after diagnosis. Sometimes they've endured multiple rounds. They're at a stage of a recurrence. So I think for either Dr. Klempner or Dr. Reddy, considering, you know, the stage of cancer that this information may be useful.
I'll just weigh in a little bit on this topic. I think there is arguments to be made for testing in numerous clinical scenarios. So I'll kind of lay out two of the more common arguments. The probably perhaps most well-supported is people who have received a targeted therapy and are no longer responding to it. So the best data here comes from lung cancer, where we have more targets than in other tumor types. Understanding why a patient's tumor is no longer responding is now capable of guiding what you would do next. For example, the classical T790M mutation in lung cancer. We now have one drug approved specifically for that indication. In ALK rearranged lung cancer, the resistance landscape actually is a very hot area, and depending on the specific resistance mutation, whether it's a secondary ALK mutation or a bypass tract in another part of the cell, can actually quite well inform the next line of therapy. So resistance or progression after targeted therapy is a very well-supported indication. Perhaps the others are when you are exhausted the standard of care, so patients with GI cancers who receive, you know, two lines of or three or four lines of therapy where there's no further therapies that have been shown be associated with the survival benefit, that's a time in the clinical care when you should look for new approaches, whether that be clinical trials or genomically directed therapies, off-label if no access to a trial. But personally, my bias is to test basically at diagnosis of metastatic disease, to use that information. Sometimes we keep it in our back pocket if it's not going to change our initial management. But we have that as a baseline to compare over time. There is perhaps less data to support that approach, but I think all of our ongoing trials are believers in that approach, and so we're collecting this data, but it will take, you know, large data sets and prospective collection to see if that bears out. But most commonly is exhaustion of standard of care or progression on targeted therapies. Evaluation for immunotherapy and testing at first diagnosis, I would say, are things that I'm adopting, but maybe less universally adopted at this time.
Yeah, I'd like to just add one thing to that, and this is certainly not true for all cancers, but in the cancer that I know the most about, which is prostate cancer, we do know that the cancer mutates over time. So what you might see from a biopsy at initial diagnosis, as Dr. Templer referred to, as a baseline, is quite likely to change over time, particularly if a patient's been through many different treatments. So even if there is no what's called actionable gene, which means a gene that might respond to treatment, if you are first sequenced on diagnosis, that doesn't mean to say that if you're later in the disease progress, you wouldn't have an actionable gene. The doctors on the panel, would you want to comment on that? Any of the doctors on the panel?
Yeah, Rick, I'll jump in here. It's Dr. Reddy here. I would 100% agree with what Dr. Klempner said. I mean, that's exactly the same approach that I use in a clinic. And from my perspective, sometimes it can also be helpful in sequencing of treatments. You know, as we've talked about immunotherapy, there are situations with broader-based molecular profiling where certain biomarkers may lead you to believe that an immunotherapy is more or less likely to be helpful in that patient, even when you don't need to do testing to have approval for that immunotherapy. And so in a situation like that, it may shade a physician's choice on whether to pursue a different line of therapy. And so that's another kind of situation where having testing is useful. As far as what you said, that is also absolutely true. It is particularly true when patients are on targeted therapies, even more so than when they are on chemotherapy, that they should get retested for molecular alterations throughout the course of their disease. Another thing I'll throw on here just briefly is this question of monitoring disease progression. And this is a very, in its infancy right now, short of, say, a disease like chronic myelogenous leukemia, which has been brought up several times tonight. Basically, there is this question of potentially using this kind of testing approach to potentially monitor for progression as well. But this is, again, in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Priya, do we have anybody that's phoned in with any questions?
No, Rick. Nobody on the line yet.
So let me go back to David. David, do you have any more questions that people have sent in for us?
Yeah, I think there's one question that kind of builds nicely on what Dr. Reddy was just saying, which are the different uses of testing and precision medicine. We've talked a lot about the predictive component, trying to predict which targeted therapy or immunotherapy a patient might respond to. Dr. Reddy also just touched on the monitoring aspect. There's also prognostic potentially in terms of what's the patient's prognosis going to be. So I think since we have spent so much time on the predictive aspect, this questioner actually mentioned preventive also. So what are some of the other uses of this information?
I think
prognostic information is important, and it's a lot of times it comes as a bonus when you're looking at more broad-based genomic profiling. So say for colon cancer, for example, BRAF mutations and KRAS mutations or the absence thereof, along with clinical factors, are all independent prognostic factors that give us some information about the biology of that patient's disease. And it's possible that with time, actually, looking at more than one mutation, looking at actually large panels of mutation, that the context that prognostic mutation exists may further refine the prognosis. For example, if you look at KRAS alone, whereas if you have the information about KRAS, BRAF, microsatellite status, mutational burden, and other mutations, we may actually be able to give a roughly more granular estimate as we gather more data. So I think prognostic importance is important. Preventative medicine using genomic data is a fascinating area, and there are some large-scale ongoing efforts, mainly based off collecting circulating tumor DNA, as Dr. Reddy had suggested, such as the GRAIL project, you know, using this almost as a diagnostic test, early detection, potential early intervention. I think these are phenomenal areas of very important work, but still agreed in its infancy.
Yeah, and I would just...
Yes, please go ahead, Dr. Reddy.
Yeah, so Rick, the only other thing I would just throw in there is, in, you know, certain germline mutations, when you're talking about prevention, certainly if you have, you know, BRCA mutations, you may choose to undergo prophylactic oophorectomy, even if you had breast cancer, mm-hmm. for example. So in certain hereditary cancer syndromes that are mm-hmm. defined by some of these genetic changes, there are some, you know, standard of care kinds of recommendations for potential prevention of future cancer, but that's a very specific, you know, more of a hereditary cancer syndrome preventative mm-hmm. measure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we're going to have time for any more questions. Am I right, Priya?
Yes, we just have a couple of minutes more, Eric.
Yes. So let me, before I hand back to you to close out, I just want to thank this panel for a really excellent presentation. I think we've covered a huge amount of material in a very short period of time. I hope it's been understandable to the listeners that are out there. If you need to follow up on any of this, you can certainly write to Cure Talk, or you can write to Answer Cancer Foundation, and we'll try and get answers for you. We're info@ancan.org. That's A-N-C-A-N. A is in Apple, N is in Nancy, C is in Charlie, A is in Apple, N is in Nancy. info@ancan.org. And we'll try and answer any questions that we might not have addressed. And with that, I'm going to hand it back to Priya to close us out.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, everyone. I think that was a very, very informative session. And Rick and David, special thanks to you for getting such a great panel together for Cure Talks. And this talk will be available on Cure Talks website along with its transcript. You can visit curetalks.com for details on our upcoming talks. Also, do please check out our new no-code app development platform for launching your mobile research studies in a matter of 5 minutes at curetalks.com/appbakery. Thank you, everyone, and have a great evening.
Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you. Bye.